I am happy to announce our 2024 Banking with Life client-only event. It's going to happen Friday, October 25th, beginning with a pre-event social mixer. The day of the event is Saturday the 26th, followed by an after party. It's going to happen downtown Fort Worth. I will be speaking there. Others will be speaking as well. You'll have the opportunity to meet me, and I'm looking forward to meeting you. You'll have the opportunity to meet the whole Banking with Life team and a room full of people that practice the infinite banking concept from all over the country. Last year, we had about 130 people from 30 different states. The year before that was really good, too. This year is going to be even better. We're going to have educational presentations and talks, and that should be important to you if you're practicing the infinite banking concept. I can't wait to see you. So in this episode, my friend Barry Dyke joins us once again. He's a perennial guest. I love him. He's a friend. He's a researcher among researchers. And we primarily talked about his fourth book that was just released, The Retirement Ruse, how stock buybacks, cryptocurrencies, unicorns, and SPACs help destroy America's savings and retirement plans. I'm just 16 pages into this book, and I've got to go back over those 16 pages and highlight the fire out of it. I can't wait to finish the book personally. I think that you would enjoy reading it. And we had a great conversation. So thank you for listening. Welcome to the Banking with Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery, and I have a perennial reoccurring guest, one of my very favorites. My good friend Barry Dyke is with us, and I look forward to a lovely conversation. You know, he just released his book, The Retirement Ruse, and he's working on another book, The Powers of Manhattan 3. I don't remember the subtitle of that, Barry. And then, you know, here it is, and this is August when we're recording, so this will be released, I'm sure, in either August or September of 2024. And then we're going to have the Banking with Life team. We're going to have a live client event in October 2024, and my good friend Barry Dyke is going to be a speaker there, and he's going to maybe talk about it. He's going to talk about whatever he wants to talk about, in fact. So, Barry, thank you again for coming on. It's always, you know, it's just my pleasure to have you, see, sir, and even to know you and be friends with you. So, thank you.
James, always great to see you, and God bless you, and thank you for pushing back the frontiers of ignorance. I mean, we were both blessed to have Nelson Nash as mentors, and you know, it's hard to believe. It's been some time since he's passed, but I think we're really blessed to have him, and that's where I think we're both doing this. And but in any event, so it's thank you, and I look forward to sharing some stuff with your listeners, because this is really, really important stuff.
It really is. And I completely agree. You know, I mean, I was 14 years in the life insurance business, you know, moderately successful before I met Nelson Nash, you know, and that was, you know, 20, I don't know, a long time ago now, you know. So I have been very blessed. It's blessed my clients, future clients, their families, people. And Nelson and I talked about that many times, you know, all the people's lives that he's touched and affected, most of them he'll never know, you know, but I think we are blessed. And okay. So look, I got to tell you, the Retirement Ruse, right?
Yes, sir.
You sent me the book last week. Thank you very much. It was autographed, and I greatly appreciate that. And then you even gave little old me a shout out with Doug Jones in the back.
You and Doug Jones, you guys have been awesome. You've been great friends. I'm very, very grateful, because, you know, this stuff is not easy to do, this stuff. And, but you and Doug have always been, you know, kind of like gently push me, Barry, keep moving forward. And, you know, because doing this stuff, it gets pretty dark when you do this. And so what I'm really trying to do is spread light on the problem, James, you know, because this is just not about me. I couldn't do it. It was just about me or you or other advisors or whatever. Having American savers being in a much better position economically, because right now I think, my opinion is that the biggest problem today is a great economic inequality. And unfortunately, one of the ways they really trade, this is going, coming about, if you will, is through the control of people's savings. And any society, for any society to be successful, they have to have a good way to channel their savings. And one of the things which I bring about right at the beginning of the book is that, and I think I've discussed it with you, James, but where is America in terms of World League table standings in terms of having the best retirement system? Where do you think we are in the top 25?
Well, I know where we're at. I mean, at the bottom.
Yeah, we're 22. I mean, so we may build great weapon systems, okay? But we build, unfortunately, retirement systems. And the reason is because the 401k is a total failure. I'm not against the discipline of saving within a 401k, but the thing is that it's a casino on wheels, and really which benefits insiders and the asset managers and everyone else more so than the individual person. So this is one of the reasons why I did this. And so this would be kind of more the subject of the Pirates of Manhattan 3, which I've been working on private equity. But I wanted to delay the groundwork for what's really going on with what's going on with people's savings today. And, hence the reason they name stock buybacks. More than 50% of all trading is really companies repurchasing their own shares, which benefits mostly executives. Now, it does benefit the mutual fund shareholders, okay, but primarily executives. The cryptocurrency scam. And I think cryptocurrencies now, there will be some type of a digital currency, there is now, but I think for the most part, cryptocurrencies are counterfeiting. That's, and if you study history, they used to hang people for counterfeiting, like in England or in China and whatever years ago. And then we have the thing about the unicorn investments, which are the new hot investments, like everything from flying taxis to who knows what all, so many of these have crashed. Yeah. And then we get into SPACs, which are special purpose acquisition companies, they were blind pools in the 1920s. And Michael Milken used them in the 1980s for junk bonds. And then during the pandemic, they went crazy. And my research has found, James, that at least 40 of them have gone bankrupt, and there's a heck of a lot more to come. So I want to attack that first and then get into the next part about private equity and the state of retirement systems. But these are major problems. And the reason why I have this whole thing on the cover is because here's a person's retirement, and they're kind of in a trailer, and it's on top of a mountain, and it's about to fall off. And only in America can you save for 20, 30 years, and within 20, 30 days, watch you lose your 30% of your portfolio.
Yeah, it's horrendous. And then also unicorns. And if I go back for a moment, you sent the book to me, thank you very much, last week. You highlighted it, and I do highlight books, but sometimes I don't highlight the original when the author signs it. But since you highlighted it, right, I started reading it this morning, and I've only gotten through the acknowledgement and the introduction. Okay.
Yeah.
And then I come in this morning, and I'm looking for my highlighter, right? So I don't normally highlight the original, right, that the author autographed, but since you did, it gives me permission to go in there and highlight. And so, I'm only like 16 or 17 pages into it, Barry, right? And I've been in the financial industry for over 33 years. I'm aware of an awful lot of what goes on. Of course, no one does the research like you do. And so I'm so excited about it. I'm so glad that you've done it. And I'm going to go back and start highlighting this book, as I read through it. And I like the idea, the way that if you were to do the work that you're doing, it would be too large. So you're looking at pointing out problems, documenting, not pointing out, you're documenting what's going on. And then my understanding is the Pirates of Manhattan 3 is going to be a little bit more solution oriented. Is that?
the main problem is the private equity invasion of the life space. Because when you look at, the problem is that, and it's actually in the back of the book, roughly And this is a research done by the Alliance for Lifetime Income. They released a research report, James, on of April of this year. And they found that roughly 30.2 million people will be retiring or hitting age 65 between now and 2025, 2030. And roughly two thirds of those folks have no other income other than Social Security. So really one of the only solutions is to have some of a guaranteed stream of income, which is if you're luckily, if you're fortunate to have a legacy pension with a corporation or your estate, a government employee, like you're with the Texas teachers or whatever, you have a true pension plan. So you really don't have much to worry about. But for the majority of people, they don't have that anymore. No. And so one of the only really safe places to put your money for lifetime income is with an insurance company. There's no question about it. I'm not, but unfortunately, Wall Street has learned how to burrow its way into this pile of money, and it's getting more complex. And that's why I'll be doing Paris Manhattan 3. Yeah.
I appreciate that. Not only have they burrowed their way, I mean, if you think, and we kind of talked about this before, the cameras got going, the hedge funds, private equities, the dark pools, all of them, they're looking at why are they buying? Why are they going into the life insurance space? Right. The life insurance companies issue annuities, they issue life insurance. Oh, and they're required to have reserves. So you have all of these reserves, and then these hedge funds, private equity groups, these pools of money, and they're almost printing money out of thin air in my opinion. But they're going into the insurance footprint, and they're leveraging the reserves of these life insurance companies to the nth degree, because the average life insurance company is making 6-8% a year. These hedge funds, they don't do anything under 12%. Well, that's what they tell you. But then if you follow Barry's research through his books, what they really do behind the scenes, I mean, they may be, say, oh, we're going to earn 12% or better. That's their benchmark, what have you. They're literally printing money the way they go in and they buy these different companies, and not just life insurance companies, take them public, make them go broke, then take them private. And they own the legal companies that do all of that. I mean, they own every step of the way. And it's just a cycle that is done over and over and over. And then when you mentioned Michael Milken, the junk bond king of the 80s. He went to prison, right? And then executive
life. 21 months, though, James. They're only 20 months. You get a 10-year sentence.
Yeah, well, then they got him out. Now, the last I heard several years ago, he was a consultant to the federal government and whatever, alphabet soup organization is going to pay him all the money to do the consulting, right? But Michael Milken, he takes down, and I don't blame it all on him. I'm just saying, you take executive life, an A-plus rated company out of California, goes broke because of their junk bond portfolio. And then here, this is 2024. I was in a room full of insurance executives and people, I think a couple of years ago, and a CEO, vice president, very high up in the organization, very old company, very highly rated. She said that this is our last payment for the guarantee association that bails out executive life policyholders. 2022.
Yeah. It was 29, 30 years. The collapse, that was the biggest collapse of a life company of all time, okay, in the U.S. And it was actually 30 years for that to be paid out.
I mean, oh my gosh. And then if you even really look at that, so who pays for that? Okay, well, everybody who pays, or owns, that happened to be a mutual company. But all the life insurance, all the legal reserve life insurance, okay, if I back up. So the guarantees associated with life insurance and annuities are backed up by the claims paying ability of the issuing company, period. Yeah. Right. And then the secondary guarantee, and this is no reason to purchase it because I want to shred it if I can, or just bring light to it, is every state has a guarantee association that has, minimum levels, 250, annuities, 300,000 in death benefit for life insurance, 100,000 in cash value on life insurance. Okay. well, your state's broke, my state's broke, every other state's broke. They don't have any money, right? But they do have the power to tax. Well, who actually funded the bailout of Executive Life and these companies? Another company, Columbian Life, just went into receivership, and like last week or so, they're liquidating it. I forget what state. You probably know about that. My point is that we are paying for it. The taxpayers are paying for it. The people that own life insurance companies, they're paying for it, because the life insurance companies, that's where the Guarantee Association goes to get the funds to meet their guarantees, is from all the legal reserve life insurance companies that are doing business in that state. And they don't even have to be domiciled in that state. I mean, it's when you peel back the layers of the onion, you know, it's like you said earlier, you know, the work that you do can get pretty dark. You got to back off of it and, you know, get some of that off of you. I mean, it's ugly is my point. It's ugly.
Totally. And the whole thing is that, you know, actually there has been global bankers has already gone into receivership. And this is a freaking nightmare, which into itself, a guy by the name of Greg Lindbergh, which we'll get into. He had a company called Global Bankers, and it's just a freaking mess.
But doesn't that sound good? I mean, doesn't that sound Global Bankers, man? Doesn't that sound like ivory tower, pristine? What a name, right?
You know, and so, but the thing is the, so this is what we're seeing coming down the line, but the reason why I'm talking about this book now is because what they're doing with other people's money, you know, forget about this private equity crap, whatever you want to call it. The use and abuse of other people's money in things like cryptocurrencies, I just find it criminal. And the thing is that let's talk about FTX, because that was the biggest cryptocurrency scam of all time. 1.8 billion, James, of other people's money. Actually, it was venture capital went into it. Now, these guys, I mean, you're talking people like Sequoia and Blackstone and all these, the Thoma Bravo, all these supposedly sophisticated investors. Well, guess what? They're pretty freaking dumb. They must have even looked at the balance sheet, all right? Because they put $1.8 billion in, they convinced them to put $8 billion into the company, and went to bankruptcy roughly 2 years ago now. Now they're saying it's going to be recovered. Now, and the irony of the whole thing is where I lived, there's actually, and there was another one, Celsius Network. They put like $400 million in the Canadian Pension Fund put into that, but went bankrupt. Now, the whole thing is it's always about other people's money, James.
Yeah.
And I think really, as advisors, as just good human beings, we have a responsibility to show stewardship for this funds. But with Wall Street, you know, it's just Brian Engel, who did he's my fire pilot, who did the forward to the book, said, Barry, this is just legalized stealing. And that's what's going on, and then there's so many financial. I call it financial sorcery, James.
Right.
You know, because it's always about getting money from other people, and primarily, which is your venture capital, and Wall Street. You know, it's funny, kind of funny. I've been in this business long time, and it always comes back to Silicon Valley and Wall Street primarily, okay? And they're supposedly smarter than everyone else. Well, guess what? They're not so smart. But they control the funds. And so you see a lot of people like Sequoia or these mutual fund companies, they're making very, very stupid decisions with other people's money, but it's not their money. So they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then they control. Now, there was a great, and I actually have it in the book, Pew Research actually did not me, it's Pew, which is a very reputable, nonpartisan research think tank. They did a survey that 75% of people don't understand cryptocurrencies, and they really feel uncomfortable with it. Now, I'm looking at this stuff, I still don't understand it. But what do? They rammed it down everyone's throat on January 24th this year. Bitcoin could appear to be into ETFs and that type of thing. And this is primarily pushed through by people like BlackRock and Fidelity.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there. I think that Brian, in his foreword, he mentioned, among other threats, FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. And I think that that's a real thing. I talk about FOMO very regularly because I see it. I experience it. I've had it. But you look at things like cryptocurrency, and I own some, and I get it. You know, I wish everything was decentralized and there was small, limited, no.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Preferably. Yeah. But I believe that the end of that road is total control. Right. Total control. And the population around the world is going to demand digital currency. You know, I think it's part of the psyop of it. That's just one aspect of cryptocurrencies. But I believe it's part of a psyop, a psychological operation. We're going to demand digital currency. Then they're going to be able to control everything you do, everywhere you go. I mean, look at China. I personally believe China is, you know, part of the alpha testing, you know, in the lockdowns. And I'm not trying to be conspiratorial. You know, I'm an optimist. I believe there are still things that we can do at the you and me level, which is exactly what you do on a daily basis, whether you write about it or deal with your clients. It's what I do on a daily basis. I mean, there are things that we can do, but ultimately I see these things coming. And then, two, I've said this for years, that just the way the governments have taken over the healthcare system, right, they're going to do the same thing with the financial system. I mean, I get it. They're, you know, it's all a big, you know, the alchemy of, you know, finance in America or the world. You know, I call it an incestuous cesspool, you know, where the military industrial complex, the data complex, the financial, big pharma, all of them, it's just an incestuous cesspool, and they're not going to let somebody make more money than themselves. So my point being is, it's a matter of time, you know, before the governments take over the financial system, you know, and before that happens, you know, we have the ability to do something about it at the you and me level, right? Personally, financially.
And so this is why, you know, I really applaud what you're doing, James, because if it wasn't for guys like you getting the truth out there to people, you know, thank God, you know, they haven't clamped on the internet yet, although, you know, even us.
You mean to the extent which they really want to?
I've been pushed back on this stuff, like my YouTube stuff, whatever. They won't let it go very far. But so there's always hope, and there's always, you know, I'm a God guy, so I always believe in God, and there's always hope. But I think really people have to I think people really need to take control and be responsible, and they have to stop acting like battered spouses, you know. And this is what is happening right now with the 401ks and so forth, is that now people believe that, you know, everything's going to be okay. Well, it's not okay, and they do have to understand what's going on. And luckily, both you and I have been blessed by great mentors. You know, Nelson Nash was one, and another one, Bob Castellone, was a good friend and still is, who actually showed me the mathematics and the mechanics behind a 401k don't work. But you're not going to hear this really from the very wealthy, you know, because they're really wealthy. A 401k is a joke, you know, if you will.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I like I don't like the battered wife syndrome, but the analogy, I call it the Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, I call it the Stockholm syndrome. That's where I get very deeply into the next book. And that's, and believe it or not, the data which I have actually from Vanguard and Fidelity actually supports the whole Stockholm syndrome. So even in periods of tremendous market turmoil, James, like it's people are, 90% of the population is deer in the headlights. They do nothing really to look out for the long-term income. But if you look at a country like the Netherlands or Finland or these other countries that have really been much better, far superior retirement system than we do, there's actually guardrails and seatbelts to protect people from themselves. But only in America can you, you know, just gamble away, you know, cryptos. I mean, Fidelity is in 2021 or 22. I think it's 21. They actually allow Bitcoin and other cryptos to be into all their retirement plans, which is, to me, is freaking insane.
Yeah.
This is what's going on.
The ETFs, I think they're all available now. Crypto, you know, Bitcoin, crypto ETFs. And then too, and you know, I'm not completely up to date on the timing, but there's been a big push over the last, you know, 18 to 24 months to, when you talk about guaranteed income, there's only one financial product that delivers that, period. One. That's a guaranteed annuity, period. Now, can you get income for life on other things and what have you? Yes, you can, but it's not guaranteed, not like the annuity. But now previously, annuities in the U.S. have not been allowed to be part of a 401k.
Yeah.
Right? Wonder why. You're talking about guardrails on some of the Scandinavian companies. They have, you know, those guardrails have to be some kind of a component of a guaranteed income, I would think.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, in the Netherlands, you can't. You have to convert. You take your retirement system and convert it into an annuity. In 2023, the Netherlands was rated number one overall. So yeah, so they get it, and because purpose of retirement income, James, retirement income plan is retirement income.
Yep.
Hello. Let's keep it really simple, folks. Let's dumb it down. When you say retirement income, we're talking about retirement income plan. Hey, would you agree?
I mean, IRA, individual retirement.
Retirement. It's actually individual retirement annuity, which originally came out with. But so the whole thing is that retirement income is produced retirement income. But in Wall Street, no, with 401k, let's trade, let's gamble some more. And let's get screwed by payment for order flow, which I get into in this book, which I go through the whole Robinhood scam, how they make their money. You know how Robinhood makes their money, James?
No.
They don't make it investing. They make it a payment for order flow, which is essentially front run people's money, and they channel it through a hedge fund like Citadel, and then they get a teeny little spread. But when you're processing gazillion orders, this money, so they were getting like $800, $900 million a year, really making money on essentially a spread or annuity on payment for order flow, not making money investing. And this is a major component of a lot of these companies. So a lot of this stuff is, they're not making money honestly investing. It's you know, it's a front running, or it's a or fees or whatever. But a lot of the stuff is this, you know. So I hate to say, so much of investing really turns to the return to the mean. So everyone ends up being average in the end. So a lot of the stuff is just it's really geared to the asset managers and the people who own the company. It's not anything about the retail saver.
Yeah. What was the cash flow? Say that again slowly for me.
Was it payment for order flow?
Payment for order flow?
Yeah. Okay. So in other words, yeah. So
yeah.
That's when they route, you know, like everyone thinks it's free trading.
Yeah.
You know, there's no free trading. You know, as the old saying goes in the 70s, gas, grass, or ass, nobody rides for free. Okay. There is no such thing as free commissions. Okay. Stupid. Okay. You know, no one does anything for, we all need money to make going concern going. We all need some different profits. So the whole thing, commission-free trading, that's both. But any event, so payment for order, essentially you're creating teeny little, like penny, half of a penny spread on it and rooting it through a major like hedge fund and getting kickback. So the thing is, payment for order flow is actually illegal in the UK and is, and I think so is Canada as well. So, but it, unfortunately, an illegal practice in the UK, it actually flourishes in the United States.
So just that is exactly front running. I mean, that's exactly front running that, you know, has been outlawed since the 30s, you know. So did they just change the name? How did they just change the structure? They don't call it front running, exactly what it is, but we're just, I mean, you know, how do they make that fly in America, in the U.S., where it's not illegal? Do you know?
I mean, a lot of things like the sweep accounts, most people don't realize.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, sweep accounts. Well, what a scam that is. Actually, by the time they're investigating it now, but the sweep accounts, that's where even this has gone on during the financial crisis, when you couldn't get anything in your money. The brokerages were sweeping their money, and they were lending it out 2-3% and giving their customers like 25 basis points, 10 basis points. So they made, now Charles Schwab actually survived off that. They're making, that was, I think, the biggest source of revenue was using sweep accounts. But so there's a lot of this stuff which people think they're so smart in investing, and they get on Bloomberg or CNBC or Fox Business, and they listen to all these talking heads. Well, guess what? A lot of it is just, it's hot air. And so they make money consistently from fees and asset management fees and so on. And so a lot of the whole expertise that they think they know, it's bullshit.
Yeah. And two, you know, back to the retirement ruse, you know, I knew, you know, at least at a fundamental level, that the companies doing their stock buybacks and they're being profitable. It's like issuing stock. It's akin to printing money. And there's a certain amount of that goes on, right? But 50%,
yeah.
50% of the rise in the market during that time period, I think you touched on it.
Yeah, it is 50%. And let me just for the reader, just so, because I am just too, it's stupid. I mean, it's just examples in this. I'll give a great example, Lehman Brothers, okay, which is the largest corporate bankruptcy of all time. In 2007, prior to going bankrupt, they spent $2.6 billion buying back their own stock. Okay, and then 2008, prior to them going bankrupt, James, they spent $1.5 billion more on their stock. What happened to Lehman Brothers? They went bankrupt. Okay, companies like Intel, I get into, Intel has spent, I don't know, it's just, they spent over $100 billion on buybacks. Okay, and the stock's gone backwards. Or better yet, J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan spent $117 billion. And that's with a B, and I'm not making any something. Check out the filings if you don't believe me. And, you know, I don't know what, it's one time high. It was 172 a share. Last time I looked at it, it was around $143 a share. So they spent $117 billion and the stock went nowhere. Then you have Citigroup, which is, I call, kind of shitty group, but I mean, so much money on and they're in trouble. And Credit Suisse, which is the Swiss bank, goes from one scandal to the next, spent $12.83 billion. Okay. Check it out, folks. Don't take my word for it. They spent $12.83 billion repurchasing their shares. And I got this. You know where I get this off? Their website.
They're not ashamed. They're proud of it. What are you talking about?
Between 2002. Okay. I got this off their website. Between 2005 and 2012, they actually brag about this stuff. They spent close to $13 billion repurchasing the shares. And what happened to them? They essentially imploded in March of 2023, and they had to be merged with UBS. So you see this stuff.
They had to be merged. That was a sweetheart deal is what that was. UBS.
And matter of fact,
UBS, Payne Webber. It's almost like when you mentioned Drexel earlier, you know, my memory goes back to Drexel, Burnham, Lambert. And then before that, it was Lambert and Drexel. They were all independent, and then they merged. That was a sweetheart deal with UBS and not Deutsche Bank, but Credit Suisse. That was a sweetheart deal.
Yeah, and everything's so much in secrecy. Do you know, James, which I found out from a friend, but it's true, I need people to Google it, is that it, it's such a bad transaction that the records are sealed on this transaction for the next 50 years.
No way.
It was so bad. Okay. And that's why I get
talk
into,
about it.
You know, that's why I get into things like the SPACs. There was a guy by the name of Michael Kleine, K-L-E-I-N-E. Oh, he had a, he was kind of like one of these SPAC kings. And he was a Citigroup banker, and he went on his own. He created M. Kleine and Associates, and he brought all these companies public using SPACs. And matter of fact, Credit Suisse, now this is stupid. They spent $175 million buying his investment banker practice, and he was going to bring Credit Suisse, First Boston, back into the limelight in American investment banking. That was his designation, okay? Now, he did a lot of shitty deals, but I get into the deals like a Multiplan, which was, it was almost like a corporate gangbang of private equity. And then he brings it public. And I think it, I don't know if I traded, looked at it yesterday, but I think Multiplan went public in a SPAC at around $10 a share. I think it's 32 cents, 35 cents now. So they're hanging on by a thread now, and this is through a SPAC. So if you couldn't make this stuff up, that's why I had to do this.
You know, that reminds me of Lehman Brothers, say, or forced out. That was a push out, in my opinion. You know, they're bailing everybody else out, but not Lehman Brothers. You know, it's like the pack turns on itself kind of a situation. But I remember that date. I can go pull the date up because I bought a life insurance policy on the exact date, right? And I didn't realize this until 2 or 3 years later. And I'm, you know, spending some time with a young agent, just showing him how life insurance works and why, you know, how to structure or whatever. And he pointed it out to me. He said, James, because the issue date, right, is always on the policy. He goes, you know, he just pointed that date out. And he said, do you understand the significance of that date? And I said, no, you know, it's like, no, I don't. And it was the date that that Lehman Brothers went broke. And so it gave us an opportunity. And so that was looking back, right, at the time. And so you look at Lehman Brothers, what happened at the date. Of course, that's a terrible date for them, right? And then compared to a life insurance policy issued on that date, which would you rather have? You know, it's in my mind, I know what I'd rather have. I'm just saying I remember the date. I can go pull the date that Lehman Brothers went out. And then if I go back to Citi, you mentioned Citigroup and your terminology for them. Citigroup, right? They own Citibank, right? And if I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, they purchased Prime America, who purchased A.O. Williams. So the old buy term and invest the difference, and I'm not slamming on that any of the entities or individuals. It's the concept that I learned in my experience over 33 years, because I started my career 33 years ago buying term and investing the difference. I bought that hook, line, and sinker. So, you know, you fast forward 33 years, but early on, I'm like, no, that's not the solution. My point here is Citibank, Citigroup owns Citibank, owns Prime America bought A.O. Williams. So they're telling all of their consumers to buy term and invest the difference. But wait, how much whole life, guaranteed permanent life engine? They don't buy IULs and they don't buy VULs. I don't care what anybody says on social media. I wonder why. Because of the guarantees. So they buy whole life insurance. And so how many billions of dollars do they own, Citigroup, and whole life insurance, while they're telling their clients and their customers to buy term and invest the difference? It's almost, do what I say, not what I do, across the board in this financial paradigm that we live in today. Okay, so we went a little long in this episode, so we're going to pick it up from here in part 2 next week. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.